From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is scheduled to announce his decision on the Paris Climate Agreement this afternoon in the White House Rose Garden. The deal was agreed to by former President Barack Obama last year, but President Trump is widely expected to pull the United States out of the agreement. Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma is a senior member of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He joins us from Tulsa. Senator, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Jeremy.
And you co-authored a letter with Senator Barrasso of Wyoming calling on the president to exit the Paris Agreement. Why do you think that that's the best move for the U.S.?
Well, it's the best move for the U.S. because the president went to the meeting in Paris, and there are 192 countries there, and those countries assume, most of them don't know that we have a Congress and that the president cannot unilaterally commit us to something that in this case was impossible. So we really don't want to subject ourselves to possible lawsuits, because what he had said at that meeting is the United States would reduce its CO2 emissions by 27% by 2025. Now, we immediately at that time, and keep in mind, this was his EPA. We went to his EPA and we said, is this possible to do it? And they said, no, it's not. So we knew that he was committing us to something that would be impossible for us to do. And obviously, it would be very, very expensive. And there are other arguments, too. But the main thing is, it's something that we couldn't do. It would be impossible to do.
So your objection to it is that we wouldn't be able to achieve the goals?
No, my objection to it is that it'd constitute probably the largest tax increase in the history of America, and you don't get anything for it. And so I object to that, but I'm saying that when the president made this commitment, he's making a commitment on behalf of the United States. And let's keep in mind, Jeremy, we've voted on this issue many times, and they'd be lucky to come up with 30% of the elected officials that would agree that we should be doing something. And so, you know, it's the president speaking out against the will of the American people.
What do you say to people, though, who do support this agreement, including hundreds of businesses, including ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, that said the U.S. should stay in because then they'll have a seat at the table, that actually may help discourage policies that would hurt some U.S. industries?
It's not true at all. The seat at the table was established back in 1992. That's when the United States, they had the United States framework on the Convention for the Climate Change. If you remember, that's these conferences of parties. Every year in December, they have these in exotic places. The most recent one, of course, was in Paris. Now, that's when they establish who's going to be at the table. We are there permanently, and apparently some of the people who are saying that we want a seat at the table have another reason for wanting this. A lot of these are giant corporations that are very heavy in other countries and have other interests that are not necessarily inuring to the best benefit of the United States.
Are you worried that leaving, though, would drive a wedge between us and our close allies, especially in Europe?
No, I don't think so. Let's look at in Europe, the Brits, for example, they've not come up with anything that is an agreement that they are to adhere to. In the other countries, we're talking about 192 countries. The vast majority of these countries are coming to these annual meetings every December in seeking large amounts of money. I've talked to some of the people that I know that come from countries like Benin, West Africa, where I said, you know, what are you doing here? Well, this is where the money is. And so it's the biggest party of the year. And, you know, they've been trying to do this now for 21 years, and they have not been successful so far. And I think that the Paris Agreement, keep in mind, this is just kind of a gentleman's agreement.
It's not a treaty, is what you're saying, that requires approval from Congress.
That's right. It doesn't. Although that could be subject to some litigation as to whether or not it should be a treaty, and this is what we could avoid by doing it. But keep in mind, they are saying that they wanted to do something that were not in the best interest of the United States and the elected officials of the United States.
Well, there are some who think that it would be in the best interest of the United States, especially because of the effects of climate change. And we should note that you've been critical of the idea that climate change is a danger to the world and driven by humans. You've said that global warming was the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. You brought a snowball to the Senate floor to underscore your skepticism. Has your thinking changed on that at all, or do you still believe it's a hoax?
No, not at all. Let's keep in mind, I wrote a book called The Greatest Hoax, and you ought to let the people out there know that it's out there. You read that, and you get the whole history of what has been happening. When you say that climate change is said was a greatest hoax, that's not true at all. In fact, on the floor of the Senate, over and over and over again, I said, climate has always been changing. It always will be changing. All the history will tell us that. The archaeology will tell us that. The Bible will tell us that. That's not the issue. It's, is the world coming to an end because of man-made gases? That's the hoax. And that's something that is, you can talk to different scientists and they'll talk about the role that CO2 plays in terms of climate change, and that is the issue. It has nothing to do with the fact that climate is always changing.
Are you happy with the Trump presidency so far?
I'm really happy with it, and one of the reasons I'm happy is that he's been able to successfully, either through executive orders or CRAs, do away with some 47 very damaging regulations that came from the Obama administration. That was all done in 100 days. Pretty remarkable, I think.
That's Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma. Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, turning to the country's ongoing opioid crisis, Ohio is the latest state to sue drug manufacturers over their marketing of painkillers. Mississippi took similar action back in 2015. Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine is taking on 5 companies, saying they've contributed to the overdose crisis in his state. Ohio leads the country in opioid deaths with more than 4,000 last year. Joe Ingles from member station WOSU in Columbus reports.
Christina Arredondo knows about opiate addiction. The Southeast Ohio resident's daughter, Felicia Detty, became addicted after pills were prescribed for her when she was 18 years old after dental surgery.
It never went away. It was a battle that she fought every moment of every day.
And in 2015, when her daughter was just 24 years old and 5 months pregnant, she died from an overdose from opioids.
She loved with all of her heart, but she suffered for something that she lost the fight to, no matter how hard she tried to fight. And to think that people do this to make money.
Arredondo was on hand yesterday when Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine announced his lawsuit against 5 drug manufacturers, saying they have made millions of dollars overselling these painkillers to doctors and customers by deceiving doctors and without disclosing the addictive nature of the opioids.
In 2016, 2.3 million Ohioans were prescribed opioids. That's roughly 1/5 of our state's population.
DeWine says these companies have put profits ahead of the well-being of Ohioans. He's asking for a jury trial, and he's asking these drug companies to pay damages that could then be used to help fight the opioid battle.
It is just and it is right that the people who played a significant role in creating this mess in the state of Ohio should pay to clean it up.
DeWine, who is expected to run for governor next year, says the opioid problem costs the state hundreds of millions of dollars in Medicaid, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, and other state programs. And he says the problem is responsible for an increased need for foster care that costs about $45 million a year when drug-addicted parents can no longer take care of their own children.
You know, I think it's too little, too late.
That's David Pepper, head of Ohio's Democratic Party. He ran against DeWine back in 2010 and says legal action against drug companies should have been taken years ago.
For 6 years, he's had town hall meetings. He's had press conferences. He said the solutions were coming. The problem was peaking. And every year it's gotten worse.
But state officials say they've taken steps to crack down on opiate prescribing by requiring doses be logged in an automated reporting system and shutting down pill mill operations that dispensed a large number of opioids. Some of the drug companies named in the lawsuit say they can't comment on pending litigation right now, but Jessica Castle-Smith, a spokeswoman for Janssen Pharmaceuticals, one of the named companies, sent a written statement saying the allegations are both legally and factually unfounded. The statement went on to say Janssen has acted appropriately, responsibly, and in the best interests of patients when it comes to their FDA-approved drugs. The case has been filed in Ross County, where Christina Arredondo lives. A court date has not yet been set. For Here and Now, I'm Joe Ingles in Columbus, Ohio.
It has been 40 years since Bob Marley and the Wailers released the album Exodus. Time magazine called it the best album of the 20th century. But it came out just after Marley had survived an assassination attempt in Jamaica amid political violence there before an election. He left for England, and that's where he recorded Exodus. Bob Marley's son, Ziggy Marley, is reissuing Exodus this week and joins us now. Ziggy Marley, welcome back to Here and Now.
Yeah, man. Good to be back.
And if I'm doing the math correctly, you would have been just 8 years old when this album came out. Do you remember it?
I mean, I remember seeing the album. We were in Jamaica, obviously, so I remember seeing the album and it was so cool. The album artwork and that just the Exodus logo, it was so cool.
Well, we mentioned all the turmoil surrounding this album, the assassination attempt and the violence in Jamaica. Did your dad talk to you about that?
No, man, we experienced it, you know, we were a part of that experience too. Because we were on the night of the incident, the police had to come for us. I remember that vividly. So that whole experience and that time when he left Jamaica, went to Nassau first, the whole family went with him, and then he went to England where Exodus was after that.
How did he talk about his music at that time and what he was trying to do with it?
Well, I don't know how him talk about it, but I can sense that the whole experience had a very spiritual effect on him. I think Exodus reflects both sides of that experience, both the spiritual and the human side. And I think he got more courage. To me, Exodus is a very courageous album, a very forward-thinking album, adventurous album. So that's how I can judge how that experience might have affected everything else after that.
What do you mean when you say it's forward-thinking?
Well, compared to what we think of the genre of reggae to be, Exodus is a very progressive interpretation of that with instrumentation that is not in the norms of reggae. Because when I was doing when I did the raw tracks and started to mix, I heard things that wasn't even in the original that I was like fascinated by because it was so outside of the box of what we think reggae, what should be in reggae. And I was very happy to hear that. And it gave me, like, I was like, well, let me put this in because this wasn't in the original, but I find it to be very cool, you know. So those little elements helped to make the restatement version of the album kind of unique.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of a song off of the new reissue. This is Guiltiness. This is from a live performance at the Rainbow Theatre in London in 1977. So first of all, just listening to that, I have to say, what an incredible and unique voice he had. Just listening to the way that he sings in a way that nobody else does. Even you. And you sound somewhat like him sometimes, but you're not. It's not exactly that.
No, I got my own thing. I got my own style.
You got your own style, exactly.
But it has a little bit of him, but it's my own thing.
Well, and there were so many issues that were important to him. And, you know, he sang about South African apartheid, imperialism. His Rastafarian religion was a big theme. What do you think he would be singing about today if he were still alive?
Well, today, I think love, you know, kind of like what I'm singing about. Love, love, we need love. The world needs love. The answer is love. The answer is love. And I think I'm in that same place as he would be with that conclusion. And that would be the mission, you know?
Mm-hmm. When you listen back to some of those old songs and those kinds of themes, what do they mean to you?
Oh wow, yeah. Why them inspire? It's inspirational to me. It's like I feel a movement, you know, like I feel the spirit of revolution. When that's how I experience these records. When I, you know, if I'm in my studio and I'm listening to some of these stuff, it gives me great inspiration to go work on my own stuff now. Hmm. You know, so it revs me up, man. It revs up my insides.
Well, let's hear another one. And this is one that everybody knows, and it plays all the time still on the radio. This is Jamming.
Well, all right, we're jamming. I want to jam it with you. We're jamming.
Do you think that when people hear these songs today at a barbecue or on the radio or out at a club, that they remember your dad's political messages, or has that been diluted over time?
Yeah, no, I don't think they remember the political messages. No, no, not everyone, and not in certain type of settings. You know, it reflects differently say a barbecue or an outdoor setting or something like that. It's just a song for enjoy. But sometimes if you're by yourself and you're listening to the same song, your perspective changes, and then might get the political or spiritual thing from it, you know.
But these songs live on even if you don't pay attention at all to the words that are being spoken, right? I mean, just the tune.
Yeah, just the vibe of it. And then, it's just the vibe of the whole thing. It's the whole package. It's my father, the bass, the drums. They were in, because when they went to England during this period of time, it was one of the first times that they were together in one. They rented like an apartment building, and all the musicians were living in the same place. When they were in Jamaica, everybody would go to their separate homes.
Hmm.
So during the Exodus recording was one of the only times the band was really like living together in the same space. And that, you know, that brought Exodus. That was something different and something unique to Exodus.
What's your favorite song from this new re-release?
You know, for me, I the track I like, because when I was mixing, the track I like the most was Natural Mystic. Hmm. Because I heard these pianos that wasn't on the original, and I was like, oh, I really love this. It gives it a different feel, and then I have Bob harmonizing himself also, which also gives the song a whole different type of vibe, you know, a fresh vibe, you know, something new. So Natural Mystic would be the one from my version of the album.
All right, well, one of my favorites we're going to play now, this is Turn Your Lights Down Low.
Turn your lights down low. And pull your window curtains. Oh, let your moon come shining in into our life again. Saying, ooh, it's been a long, long time. I get this message for you, girl.
I hate to even turn that down, Ziggy Marley. Just let that play out for the rest of the segment. Yeah, turn it up. Right. Well, so what do you, you now have children of your own. What do you tell them about your dad?
Well, them ask questions sometimes, you know, like, especially Gideon asked me a lot about the assassination attempt, you know, why people was trying to shoot grandma and grandpa and what was going on. So we just tell them the truth, really, you know, and take out the gory details for fit them age, you know. Your grandfather is someone that stood up for certain things and certain people didn't like it, certain people still don't like it. You know, and so them try for hurt him, you know. So, yeah, I mean, we keep it simple, but we tell the truth.
That's Ziggy Marley, the son of Bob Marley, speaking with us about Exodus 40. The movement continues. That's a new reissue of his father's 1977 album. Ziggy Marley, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Hey, man, good day. Thank you, brother.
There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. I can't tell no lie. If you listen carefully, now you will hear. Such a natural mystic.
And we're listening to that song Ziggy Marley mentioned, Natural Mystic. It's from his reissue of his father's 1977 album, Exodus. This is Here and Now.
The Cleveland Cavaliers and Golden State Warriors meet for Game 1 in the NBA Finals tonight, a rematch of the last two NBA Finals. The Warriors won the title 2 years ago. The Cavs took it last year. Sports commentator John Bacon is with us to talk about that and some of the other sports news of the week. Hi, John.
Hello, Robin.
So you got Golden State, Steph Curry, favorite in the series. But last year, Cleveland fought back from a 3-1 deficit. They won it. And, oh, yeah, they have LeBron James. How do you see it?
It's a toss-up. No one really knows much at this point, I think. You've got, like you said, two of the best players in the NBA, six MVP titles between them. And, of course, LeBron is the king. However, I'm 5'8", Robin. So I always cheer for the little guy. And the little guy in this case is 6'3", Steph Curry. So yeah. Go little guy.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if people are concerned about LeBron James, you know, where his head might be at. We know there was racist vandalism at his home in Los Angeles early yesterday, racist graffiti. He spoke publicly saying, being black in America is tough. We've got a long way to go. I have to say, I sent my guy and our nephew to Game 5 here in Boston against Cleveland. The invective against LeBron James was terrible. My guy got up and told the Celtics fan to shut up. You know, it was bordering on racist. Are there concerns about LeBron James' mental state in tonight's game?
Although he's taken on quite a lot, and let's not minimize this, of course. And to be clear, by the way, somebody spray-painted a racial epithet on the gate of his L.A. home.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter who you are in America, apparently, you're going to see some of this stuff, sadly.
Right.
So
right.
That is a serious business, to say the least. LeBron James is one mentally tough guy. And what I've never gotten generally, aside from the racism, which speaks for itself, is the general atmosphere of LeBron hate in America. I don't get it. This guy has been a model citizen. At age 18, he got $90 million in global fame. If you had given that to me, Robin, I don't like what the future looks like.
Right, might not have ended up that well. Well,
exactly. Yeah. This guy has not had any problem with the law, married his high school sweetheart. He's got raising three very good kids. He backs the Boys and Girls Club of America,
yeah.
And he's helped fund 2,300 scholarships at the University of Akron. So I don't know what the beef is with this guy. Again, aside from the racism, which speaks for itself.
Moved away but came back, you know. So listen, I just
came back to Cleveland to win
the
title.
Right. Let's just briefly touch on the ice in the Stanley Cup Finals. The Pittsburgh Penguins lead the Nashville Predators 2-0 after last night's 4-1 win. Who do you see there, and why did someone throw a catfish on the ice?
The Penguins are up 2-0. They stole game one, so chances are it's going to be the Penguins. However, the catfish. Back in the 1950s, some Detroit Red Wings fan threw an octopus onto the ice to indicate the 8 arms, 8 wins you needed back then for a Stanley Cup title. When they're playing Nashville in 2004, Nashville's first playoff appearance, They countered the octopus with their local fare, the catfish. And I didn't say it made sense, Robin. I just said that's where it comes from.
Listen, in the last minute here, Tiger Woods. Everyone saw that mugshot this week. Arrested on a DUI charge, but he passed the breathalyzer. There was no alcohol involved. He said it was an unexpected reaction to prescription medicine. Is this a different story at the end of the week than it was at the beginning?
It is, and it's going to evolve further. This man has already had 4 operations on his left knee. He's had 3 on his back and other operations as well. He has probably got a lot of prescription drugs right now, and this is just, frankly, a very sad, almost Greek tragedy, this fall from grace.
Right. Well, but it was not, you know, drinking while driving. We'll see.
It was not. He blew a 0.00, to be very clear about that.
Sports commentator John Bacon. We'll follow that story and others. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Opioid addicts are fighting so many demons, it's sickening to think they may also be prey to middlemen, giving them a false hope of recovery. A new investigative report makes the case that addicts like Patrick Graney and others did fall prey to these middlemen. Patrick left the Boston area last summer after a well-known recovering addict who seemed to be doing well, sober, driving a Mercedes, offered Patrick a golden opportunity, an all-expenses-paid trip to a luxurious rehab facility in sunny South Florida. But once there, Patrick texted family and friends the facilities were terrible. His insurance, supposedly covered by the middleman in Boston, was terminated. His family rented hotel rooms for him as they worked to bring him back. But 2 months after arriving in Florida, Graney was found dead of an overdose in one of those hotel rooms. Patrick's story and the story of these alleged middlemen is told in an investigative report from our partners at STAT, the health and science publication. David Armstrong is one of the co-authors, along with the Boston Globe's Evan Allen. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us more about Patrick Graney, 31 years old, off and on heroin user. His family was just trying to keep him alive, it sounds like, until he could maybe get over the addiction.
Yeah, I mean, his story is pretty typical of people suffering from opioid addiction who, you know, are not successful in treatment. He was a chronic relapser. He'd be sober for a while and then relapse. And this is the kind of person that these middlemen we wrote about, these brokers, are looking for. Because they are chronic relapsers, they're going to be in and out of treatment all the time, and that makes them more valuable.
And let's introduce the middleman you talked to. This is very odd, actually, because he is seen by many people as an angel who helped them recover. He does run sober homes and recovery facilities here in the Boston area. And you say what about his relationship with Patrick Graney?
Well, he knew Patrick Graney. They apparently connected when both of them were using drugs and developed something of a friendship. So when Patrick was relapsing, this middleman reached out to him and said, "Hey, how would you like to go to Florida? All expenses paid." Now, the middleman denies this, we should say. That's important.
And by the way, the facility in Florida denies that they used a middleman, but you have texts.
Yeah, we have essentially Patrick Graney speaking from the grave because his Facebook account was preserved and his messages have been preserved there. And he repeatedly describes the arrangement in the terms that I just did. A free trip to Florida, his insurance paid for, his airfare paid for. And for a person like Patrick Graney, this was a dream come true. You know, he'd been struggling in Boston. He gets to go somewhere new. His girlfriend said he was shown pictures of a fabulous resort-like atmosphere. So he was on a plane literally the next day.
Yeah. How is it that these scams run? I mean, why would somebody give somebody free airfare, a free stay at a recovery center? What's the money trail?
And pay their insurance premium.
Right.
It's a small cost of business. Why? Because the amount of money that's being billed on private insurance policies that they enroll them in is tens of thousands of dollars. So the cost of a flight plus the $200 to $300 a month premium is really just a token amount when you consider the massive amounts that the treatment centers are able to bill these private insurers.
Are the insurers legitimate?
The insurers are legitimate, and there's an important distinction to be made here. The brokers and these middlemen are not dealing with government insurance programs. Why? Because they don't pay well. They don't want anything to do with Medicaid. in this scenario, the insurance companies are being victimized. They don't know when they're getting these bills how people were induced down to Florida. And again, the reimbursement rates are even higher for someone, say, from Massachusetts and Florida because they're out of network. It's massive amounts of money that are at stake with just even a single patient.
Well, and some would say, well, again, you know, following the money, if the money's being paid out for somebody's treatment, well, surely the money will go to treatment. But the way they can make the money from these insurance companies is apparently, according to Patrick Graney, who wrote back to his girlfriend when he got to this facility, they're not getting the treatment.
That's right. We've talked to many people that have made this trip at the behest or arrangement of brokers, and most of them are inevitably disappointed. They find that the facilities are not as advertised. You know, they're not living some luxurious life on a beach. The services are limited. You know, the amount of treatment they're getting is modest at best. And many of them want to come home after that. Patrick Graney at some point wanted to come home, but couldn't find his way back here. He even asked his broker for bus money. We don't know what happened, whether money was sent or not, but we know he didn't come home. But again, to be fair, they say they don't use brokers and that Mr. Graney was removed from a house because he allegedly brought heroin in. You know, that's their word. We don't have Patrick Graney around to respond to that.
Yeah. Well, to get an idea of how big this is, you describe what's happening in Palm Beach County. So packed with treatment facilities, they call it the recovery capital of the world. You can go to the Dunkin' Donuts in Delray Beach, and what do you see?
So if you just sit at any coffee shop, actually, in Delray Beach, and frankly, anywhere in that area, one of the first things that strikes you is how many white vans are driving up and down the streets there. And almost all of them are shuffling rehab patients from inpatient facilities to the places they live. We just sat in a Dunkin' Donuts for an hour and just watched a constant stream of these vans pulling in and out. People coming out, they'd either get a smoke or get a cup of coffee. In Delray Beach alone, which is a small city, 16 square miles, there's 800 treatment facilities.
Yeah.
I mean, literally every block has a sober house, a halfway house, or a treatment facility. It's really an incredible sight.
Well, and some of them are legitimate, but we understand that by 2016, the state appropriated $250,000 to create a task force to go after these corrupt operators, including people doing patient brokering. So that seems to underscore this is happening.
It is happening. We spoke to the state attorney for Palm Beach County, which includes towns like Delray Beach. He simply got sick and tired of the problem. By that, I mean people are overdosing and dying on the beaches. And he also found out that three quarters of the private pay patients at these facilities were from other states. So clearly something was going on. So the state appropriated money for him to set up a task force, and they are going after these bad actors, the really bad treatment centers, and they've already put some people in jail. And we expect other counties down there now will start similar efforts.
Well, meanwhile, others are looking into this. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey's office told you they're looking at these out-of-state treatment centers. I'm sure other states are. But again, back to this idea of brokers, people who shepherd these people down to Florida to these recovery centers. And these recovery centers don't give a lot of recovery, but bill private insurers tens of thousands of dollars. You say they're paid in two different ways. One's a per head fee, one's a monthly fee. How are they paid?
Yeah, so there's two common arrangements, and we spoke to people who are in or have been in the brokering business. One is a per head fee, so a typical fee if you place somebody in a inpatient setting in Florida is $3,000 to $5,000 a head. So that's one way it works. The other is people are on a monthly retainer, some as high as $30,000, $40,000 from what we've been told. But they have to meet a quota. They have to get a certain number of patients into the facility per month to maintain that arrangement.
This is heartbreaking, you know, because this is a scourge right now, the opioid addiction and overdose epidemic. And these are people who are trying to get help. Maybe they can't get beds. There's not enough beds where they live. This must seem like a golden ticket.
It is. And they're desperate, as you mentioned. It's really perverse if you think about it, because in a lot of cases, the people being recruited to go out of state are being recruited by people in the recovery community. So they're being victimized in some cases by people that know the exact pain they're suffering from. So it's almost unimaginable to think that this could be going on. Mm. But as you pointed out earlier, there's a lot of money involved here. Mm. And some people do it saying, well, they think they're helping people while they're making the money. But the reason they're sending people to a particular facility is not necessarily because it's the best facility for someone to go to, but because they're being paid to do it.
That's David Armstrong, a reporter for STAT and one of the co-authors of their investigation into addiction recovery middlemen and brokers. He was also writing with the Boston Globe's Evan Allen. David, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks, Robin. I always appreciate it.
So, have you had an experience with a rehab broker? And maybe you thought it was a positive experience. Let us know.
After 6 years at CBS Evening News, Scott Pelley has left the anchor's chair. The change comes as CBS's ratings continue to lag behind rivals ABC and NBC, and as cable news audiences surge. Pelley will be moving to a full-time role at 60 Minutes, which still attracts a huge viewership. We're joined now by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this move was a bit of a surprise. What is CBS saying about why they're booting Pelley from the evening news and sending him over to 60 Minutes?
Well, I think fundamentally what they're saying is that 60 Minutes is more important. It has a far greater audience. It is in some ways the chief economic propellant of CBS's news division. And the senior executives there, led by the news division's president, David Rhodes, believe that Pelley's pretty much a perfect fit for that. And remember, 60 Minutes has gone through some deaths, some retirements, and there are likely to be some other senior correspondents retiring in the next couple of years. Scott Pelley's contribution to the show, which he was still doing while full-time anchor, as the evening news, had declined. And they wanted to make sure they had somebody to really, a major pillar for such an important show.
Well, one of the other storylines, though, that has emerged about this is that Scott Pelley has been particularly skeptical towards President Trump. Let's listen to him back in February.
Today, we learned the length of the president's fuse, 28 days. After 4 weeks of being blocked by courts, challenged by Congress, and held to account by the public, President Trump called a hasty news conference and went on offense with the familiar tools that built his career: bluster, bravado, exaggeration, and a few loose facts.
What do you think, David? Is that tougher on President Trump than anybody else?
I think he's been very blunt about it. He's wanted to call things precisely as he sees it. I think that Pelley, not notably an ideologue, has embraced the idea that CBS has put forward that it is going to be serious news organization, more serious hard news organization, in a way to differentiate itself from the softer focus often embraced at NBC and ABC, and that this moment requires clarity. He only has about 19 and a half minutes to play with on that evening newscast. He wants to be direct and to the point at a moment of real and in some ways self-inflicted crisis created by the Trump administration.
How important are the evening newscasts at this point? We've been hearing for years about declining audiences across the board.
I think that they remain a way for the network to brand itself and for particularly the news division to brand itself around a unifying figure, even though, 60 Minutes, as I said, is much more important financially and is itself, the number one in some ways news show in America. And the morning shows for the other two major broadcast networks are the economic engines really for those news divisions. They help to brand it. They also help to provide continuity and identification for the local stations that are either owned by the networks or affiliated by them. Those local news programs are huge economic engines for those stations. And so, if you lose an anchor, if you don't have somebody that audiences react to, it can have a ripple effect. Part of what people were saying with Pelley was that he had done well to stabilize the show and increase ratings in the early years. Over the last year or so, he really had declined more precipitously than the others. And they want to close that gap, even as they recognize they're not operating at the same level for that show.
Okay, let's talk about NBC and what's happening there. Former Fox News host Megyn Kelly is going to be debuting her show this Sunday on that network. She scored an interview with Vladimir Putin for her first episode. This is going to be a very different role for Megyn Kelly. How do you think she'll take to it?
Well, I think it's an open question. They are basically trying to eat into the 60 Minutes franchise with this news magazine show, a mixture of long-form journalism, we're told, and long-form interviews.
She's going up right against 60 Minutes, right?
She's right there. I mean, they're going to debut it now and then sort of take a hiatus during the football season and come back, I think, next year. Excuse me, during the football season. And yet it's a it's not necessarily a natural fit for her. She really has aspirations to grow past being a sharply confrontational, intense cable news host reacting to the flap of the moment. This is what she wants to do combined with the morning show where she's going to have a softer focus and a gentler touch. And I think both of those are pulling at her in two very different ways, and she's going to have to learn how to do this. It sounded as though they really need to reshape it. If you think of what she did a year ago when she had a primetime special finally at her urging, thanks to then the late Roger Ailes, who was at that time still running Fox News, you know, that was a show that got bad ratings and was hit very hard by critics for being kind of formless and not really cohering. And she needs to evolve. She needs the chance to do it. She's very smart, very talented, very ambitious, very much wants to cast a new identity at NBC. The question is whether viewers, either for the 60 Minutes type competitor or for the softer morning show, are going to take to that.
Just a few seconds left here, David, but she did say once, Santa just is white. Is she going to be bringing politics to NBC?
I think she's trying to shed that skin. I think she put on that costume, if you will, because it played to the red meat of Fox viewers, right, that she needed to attract back then. I think she's trying to identify herself in a very different way now.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.